President-elect Biden spoke about what his administration would do to expand the current version of the Affordable Care Act. This as the Supreme Court heard a case that could affect the future of Obamacare. Good afternoon. This is Washington Today. I'm Pedro Echevarria. We start with today's Supreme Court oral argument on the Affordable Care Act. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh suggested Tuesday that it wasn't the Supreme Court's role to invalidate the entire sprawling 900-page Affordable Care Act, even if one or more provisions, such as the individual mandate, are deemed unconstitutional, signaling the key parts of Obamacare will survive the latest court challenge. Chief Justice Roberts said simply that if President Trump and Republicans wanted to kill the law, they could have done it. From earlier today, here is an exchange between the Chief Justice and Michael Mongan, California Solicitor General.
I'd like to begin with the standing issues. Is someone who does not follow the mandate and purchase insurance violating the law?
Not on our view, Your Honor. We think that this is an inoperative provision and there is no legal command. But even if the court were to accept the plaintiff's theory that it is a command at the standing stage, they still can't establish standing because there's no threat or even any possibility that that command would be enforced against them.
Well, so if someone who doesn't purchase insurance pursuant to the mandate applies for a job down the road and has to fill out a questionnaire asking whether you've ever violated the law, which box should he check, yes or no?
Well, I think if their view, Your Honor, is that this is a command, I suppose they'd have to say that they'd violated the law. And if they had alleged that they were applying for such a job and that the employer was going to use such a form, then that might be a viable theory of standing. But of course, there's no such allegation before us here today.
Well, let's say Congress passes a law saying everybody has to mow their lawn once a week. And they even make a lot of findings about why that's a good thing. You know, it makes the country look neater. You get fresh air if you have to do that. Supports the lawnmower business, but the fine for violating it is $0. Do they have standing? I mean, the neighbors will see that they're not obeying the law. The objectives of Congress will not be fulfilled. In other words, there'll certainly be injury to that person, and I wonder if under your theory that person would not be able to challenge the law.
I don't think that they would be on the theory that they've altered their conduct to comply with the law and they've suffered some injury. I think that follows from this court's cases in Poe and Holder and American Booksellers, that it's not enough to say that I'm injured by complying with the law. You also have to show some real threat of enforcement. And here, of course, Congress eliminated the only enforcement mechanism in 5000A.
That exchange took place earlier at the Supreme Court. Supporters of the law say the challengers have no legal injury because after Congress amended the law in 2017, there is no longer a penalty for failing to buy health insurance. Lawyers for the Democratic-led states and the House of Representatives say the court should therefore dismiss the challenges. But several of the justices floated hypotheticals, suggesting that even if there was no longer a penalty for not following a regulation, there could still be an injury, suggesting that a challenge could be brought. With more, here is Acting U.S. Solicitor General Jeffrey Wall with Chief Justice Roberts.
This case pushes at the line between faithfully following what Congress actually does rather than what it may have intended to do. When Congress eliminated the shared responsibility payment, it left standing what is now a naked command to obtain insurance. And it left standing the finding that that mandate is essential to the operation of other parts of the Act. Those choices have legal consequences, whether or not the members of Congress who voted for the TCJA foresaw them. That's how this court normally approaches interpreting statutes, and it's how this court should approach the ACA here. I welcome the court's questions.
General, your theory of standing is that a person who's not actually injured by part of the law can challenge that part of the law and through that try to strike down other parts of the law that do challenge him or that do injure him. I think that really expands standing dramatically. I mean, just in this act alone, you're talking about almost 1,000 pages, and you're letting somebody not injured by the provision that he's challenging sort of roam around through those 1,000 pages and pick out whichever ones he wants to attack.
I think the reason there isn't a floodgates problem or a sort of massive loophole, Mr. Chief Justice, and the reason we haven't seen claims like Alaska Airlines is because on the merits, it's just very rare that you're going to have the sort of textual evidence that overcomes the presumption of inseverability. And so these claims go out on a motion to dismiss if they're ever brought at all. But the theory, and Justice Alito was pressing this with Mr. Verrilli, I think, is, you know, if you imagine a statute that had a clearly racially discriminatory provision and an express inseverability clause, I think the theory of the other side is that plaintiffs regulated by that statute couldn't challenge it. And that doesn't seem right to us. The plaintiffs here have an Article III injury. They want certain kinds of insurance plans.
No, but it's a common feature. It's a common feature of standing that the result is people can't challenge provisions. I mean, it's an important doctrine. It is the only reason we have the authority to interpret the Constitution is because we have the responsibility of deciding actual cases, and that's what standing filters out.
I agree with all of that, Mr. Chief Justice. The plaintiffs here, and this is in the amended complaint at paragraph 46, and then in their declarations that appear at pages 71 to 78 of the JA, they say that they're injured because they want plans that they had before the ACA and that they cannot obtain now but for the ACA's insurance reform provisions. That's a straightforward Article III injury.
And that was Jeffrey Wall, acting U.S. Solicitor General on the ACA. Joining us with more on today's hearing, Robert Barnes of The Washington Post, who covers the Supreme Court. Mr. Barnes, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
What do you get as a sense from the various justices about what the proposals were on either side of this argument today?
Well, I mean, what I get was that there seem to be at least five justices, maybe more, who are very reluctant to say that what Congress did in 2017 when it zeroed out the penalty for not purchasing health insurance sinks the entire Affordable Care Act. Most importantly, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, two of the court's conservatives, said pretty explicitly that even if there was a problem constitutionally with the so-called individual mandate, that could be separated out from the rest of the law and that the law could continue to stand.
And so as far as the arguments brought forth by the administration, how were they treated by the various members of the court?
Well, there were three things here that the court had to decide, whether or not these Republican-led states and two individuals had what's called legal standing to bring this challenge. And then they had to decide if that was the case, did the Congress's action in 2017 make this so-called individual mandate unconstitutional? And then, as the third part, if it is unconstitutional, what happens to the rest of the law? And so there was a lot of discussion about those first two things, and it was not exactly clear, you know, what the court would say on standing or on whether this mandate was now unconstitutional. But really the sort of crux of the argument and what I think most people, certainly the more than 20 million people who have health coverage through the Affordable Care Act care about is that last part. And that was the part in which there did seem to be some agreement.
Leading up to this day, and especially during our confirmation hearings, everybody was wondering how the latest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, would weigh in and the kind of questions she would ask about this process. What did we hear from her today?
Well, we didn't hear a whole lot that gets to that sort of key question. She's at a bit of a disadvantage. You know, everything at the Supreme Court goes by seniority, and that means she is the last to ask questions. So by the time, each of the four lawyers who were arguing before the court, by the time she got to them, most of the questions had been asked and answered. And so she did ask some questions about this standing issue and that would seem to indicate you know, if it would be premature for the court to make a decision about whether the rest of the law could stand. But we didn't learn a whole lot, I have to say, about how she viewed the total argument.
When you talked about those initial five justices, you mentioned the Chief Justice, you mentioned Brett Kavanaugh. Am I assuming that the three so-called liberal justices also weighed in on this position, too?
Yes, the three liberal justices all have supported the Affordable Care Act in the previous two challenges that came to the Supreme Court. And certainly there was nothing in today's arguments that would suggest that they'd change their minds.
So, Robert Barnes, where do we go from here?
Well, we wait for a decision. And, you know, that could take some time. The court is pretty careful about these things, certainly when the constitutionality of a major piece of legislation is at stake. And we wait to see what the political climate is as well, of course. You know, even if the court found that there was a problem, it is one that could be corrected by Congress and the administration. And that will depend on, you know, who's in charge. President Trump has made it clear that if he's still around, he would like to see the Affordable Care Act ended. President-elect Biden, on the other hand, says that he plans to build on the ACA and improvement. In fact, he's giving a speech on that today. And so, you know, there's a little bit uncertainty about when we would get a decision from the court, and then also what would happen if it's something that Congress or the administration can fix.
This is Robert Barnes, who reports on issues of the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. You can find that reporting at WashingtonPost.com. Mr. Barnes, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It was over on MSNBC earlier today that Dr. Anthony Fauci addressed remarks made prior to the election where President Trump threatened to fire him. His remarks came after Dr. Fauci warned the winter would continue to be hard in regard to COVID-19 patients. Here is Dr. Fauci earlier today with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell.
You said in late October, we're in for a whole lot of hurt. It's not a good situation. We're in the wrong place going into the fall and winter season. I think you said you could not possibly be positioned more poorly. After you said that, the president told a campaign rally he would wait until a little bit after the election to fire you. Do you have any concerns that he may be pressuring Francis Collins in the near future to try to fire you?
Well, I hope not, Andrea. I don't think that that would be helpful to what our common goal of all of us are, no matter who you are, regardless of what administration. We all want this pandemic to end. My entire activity, every minute of my life right now, is devoted to trying to end this pandemic. So I would hope that I'm allowed to continue to do that because I think I do it well. I've been doing it for many, many years, and I've done it under many different circumstances, including six administrations. So to me, I'm focusing like a laser beam on the job I have of ending this epidemic and really preserving the health and the welfare of the American public.
There was another coronavirus task force meeting yesterday, I think the first one since mid-October or late October. Were you invited to that one?
Yes, I was there physically. It was a good meeting. It was chaired by the vice president, as he usually does. We spent a lot of time talking about what you and I are talking about right now, particularly the issue with the vaccine. It was very exciting news, and we all looking forward to what the ultimate effect that would be. So, yes, there was a meeting. It was a good meeting.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today on MSNBC. CNN reporting that 100,000 new cases of coronavirus, 7 days in a row, with the U.S. more than 10 million cases, more than any other country. On the heels of Pfizer's announcement on a coronavirus vaccine, the Associated Press reporting the Food and Drug Administration approved an experimental antibody drug from Eli Lilly for those 12 and older with a moderate case of COVID-19 not requiring a hospital stay. The AP reports the drug is still undergoing additional testing and the treatment is similar to one President Trump received after contracting the virus last month. The government previously reached an agreement to buy and supply much of the early production of Lilly's drug. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back. This is Washington Today for November the 10th, 2020. I'm your host, Pedro Echevarria. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday there would be, quote, a smooth transition to a second Trump administration, close quote, in the coming months. Shrugging off a question about a transfer of power by President Trump, even as America's allies began calling to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden, according to Politico, quote, the remarks from Pompeo came during a news conference at the State Department after he was asked whether the department was preparing to engage with Biden's transition team and was pressed on the potential national security risk posed by a delayed transition of power. Although it was unclear whether Pompeo was joking, he refused to acknowledge the outcome of the White House race and insisted that the election was still in the process of being determined. His rhetoric echoed other statements by the president's allies and congressional Republicans, lending credence to the Trump campaign's voting-related legal challenges, end quote. Here is an exchange with Secretary Pompeo from earlier today.
Hi.
Is the State Department currently preparing to engage with the Biden transition team? And if not, at what point does a delay hamper a smooth transition or pose a risk to national security?
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly. The world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that the State Department is functional today, successful today, and successful with the president who's in office on January 20th, a minute afternoon, will also be successful. I went through a transition on the front, and I've been on the other side of this. I'm very confident that we will do all the things that are necessary to make sure that the government, the United States government, will continue to perform its national security function as we go forward.
So you believe there's widespread voter fraud, that the reports that we're getting from Pennsylvania, from Michigan, showing vote totals and massive leads or significant leads with 99% reporting are going to be overturned, and that the United States failed to conduct a fraudulent free election?
Rich, I'm the Secretary of State. I'm getting calls from all across the world. These people are watching our election. They understand that we have a legal process. They understand that this takes time. Right, it took us 37 plus days in an election back in 2000. We conducted a successful transition then. I'm very confident that we will count, and we must count every legal vote. We must make sure that any vote that wasn't lawful ought not be counted. That dilutes your vote if it's done improperly. Got to get that right. When we get it right, we'll get it right. We're in good shape.
Should foreign leaders not be calling President-elect Biden?
It was next.
That was the Secretary of State from earlier today. The decision by Secretary Pompeo to deny President Trump's election loss came as news broke of several world leaders reaching out to make contact with the president-elect. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and British Prime Minister both tweeted that they spoke with Mr. Biden by phone, and French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel reportedly called him as well. You can find the entire briefing on our website at cspan.org. And during an event today focusing on the Affordable Care Act, President-elect Joe Biden reacted to Secretary Pompeo's remarks. Here is the president-elect from Wilmington, Delaware, earlier today.
During the campaign, you said you were not naive about how difficult it would be to unite the country. It's now 3 days after you were projected as the president-elect. The president himself says he has won this election. His own administration has not moved forward to give you access to what you need to do to begin the work of your transition. Just a few minutes ago, the Secretary of State, when asked if he would cooperate with a smooth transition, he said there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. I wonder if you have a message for the president who may well be watching right now. And how do you expect to be able to work with Republicans when so many have thus far refused to even acknowledge your victory?
Well, first of all, we are already beginning the transition. We're well underway. And the ability for the administration in any way by failure to recognize this our win does not change the dynamic at all in what we're able to do. We've announced yesterday, as you know, the health group that we put together today. We're going to be moving along in a consistent manner, putting together our administration, the White House, and reviewing who we're going to pick for the cabinet positions. And nothing's going to stop that. And so I'm confident that the fact that they're not willing to acknowledge we won at this point is not of much consequence in our planning and what we're able to do between now and January 20th.
You have a response to Secretary Pompeo, and I also wonder, you warned during the campaign that as the walls closed in on the president, he would behave more erratically. Yesterday, he fired his defense secretary on Twitter. Are you worried that he's disabling the government? And what are you saying to the world leaders who are calling you at this point about the situation here?
Well, first of all, I'm letting them know that America's back. We're going to be back in the game. It's not American alone. Number one, I've had the opportunity to speak with now six world leaders. And the response has been very fulsome, energetic, and they're all looking forward to being able to, from Great Britain to France to Germany to Canada, et cetera, and Ireland. So I feel good about the ability to. I said when we announced that the next president is going to inherit a divided country and a world in disarray. The reception and welcome we've gotten around the world from our allies and our friends has been real. I'm having a number of other calls to return, and so I feel confident that we're going to be able to put America back in the place of respect that it had before.
President-elect Biden earlier today in Wilmington, he also said the fact that President Trump has not conceded is an, quote, embarrassment. He added that the move is hurting the president's legacy. He also responded to Republicans who have not acknowledged his win and said in short, quote, they will, close quote. He also said that with a smile on his face. Here again is the president-elect.
What do you say to the Americans that are anxious over the fact that President Trump has yet to concede and what that might mean for the country?
Well, I just think it's an embarrassment, quite frankly. The only thing that, how can I say this tactfully? I think it will not help the president's legacy. I think that I know from my discussions with foreign leaders thus far that they are hopeful that the United States democratic institutions are viewed once again as being strong and enduring. And but I think at the end of the day, you know, it's all going to come to fruition on January 20th. And between now and then, my hope and expectation is that the American people do know and do understand that there has been a transition, even among Republicans who are people who voted for the president. I understand the sense of loss. I get that. But I think the majority of the people who voted for the president, a lot voted for him, a significantly smaller number, but a lot voted for him. I think they understand that we have to come together. I think they're ready to unite, and I believe we can pull the country out of this bitter politics that we've seen for the last five, six, 7 years.
And just to follow up on a previous question, how do you expect to work with Republicans if they won't even acknowledge you as president-elect?
They will. They will. Thank you all so very much. Thank you.
That was President-elect Joe Biden from earlier today. You can find his entire press conference, by the way, at cspan.org. Over on Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also reacted to Secretary Pompeo's remarks, stating that he needs to, quote, look at reality. Here are his remarks.
Well, on the transition, we saw today Secretary of State Mike Pompeo say that there will be a smooth transition between Trump's two terms. What's your reaction to him?
My reaction to that is look at reality. Secretary Pompeo, Joe Biden has won. He's won the election. Now move on. Let's bring this country together and get things done. We have a COVID crisis raging. We don't have time for these kinds of games.
That was Senator Chuck Schumer earlier today. That took place on Capitol Hill. On the other side of the aisle, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Tuesday there's, quote, no reason for alarm, close quote, as President Donald Trump, backed by Republicans in Congress, pursues legal challenges to Democratic President-elect Joe Biden's election victory. Republicans are increasingly pointing to a December deadline as they give President Trump time and space to exhaust his legal challenges. That's when the states face a deadline to certify results and a December 14th deadline for the Electoral College to cast its votes. Here is the majority leader from earlier today.
Leader McConnell, this is the third or fourth time that the president has alleged election fraud without proof. He did it during the 2016 primaries. He did it after the 2016 general election, and he's doing it now. Why do you continue to indulge him?
Well, what I'm going to do here in the Senate is concentrate on the business that we have left to do, which I mentioned a while ago. An omnibus appropriation bill, maybe another coronavirus package, and let the presidential election go through the various stages that it goes through under the Constitution. There will be apparently litigation. Those cases will be decided. And then the Electoral College will meet. And then we'll have the inauguration. But I am going to concentrate on what we are trying to do here in the remainder of this Congress.
Was there any fraud in your Senate race or any Senate race that you know of?
I'm sorry?
Was there any fraud in your Senate race or any Senate race that you know of?
I don't know. The risk of bragging, it wasn't very close.
The bipartisan 9/11 report said that the abbreviated transition period after the 2000 Gore-Bush fight contributed to the lack of security preparedness before 9/11. Shouldn't this GSA sign off on the requisite paperwork now to let the transition begin and avoid a similar crisis?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have an interrupted transition to whoever is the next administration. I think we ought to quit all the hand-wringing and not act like this is extraordinary. We're going to get through this period, and we'll swear in the winner on January the 20th, 2021, just like we have every 4 years since 1793.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, that from earlier today on Capitol Hill. According to the Associated Press, quote, President Trump's Republican allies in Congress have largely declined to congratulate Biden, and instead they are backing up Trump's efforts to pursue legal challenges, even though privately many Republicans doubt he has any legitimate path to change the outcome. Trump and his GOP allies haven't offered any proof of election fraud, and their legal challenges have largely been rejected by the courts, end quote. Speaking of matters of transition, the Trump administration has not yet provided a letter of ascertainment from the General Services Administration that would give the incoming administration millions in transition funding, allow key Biden transition members to access current government officials, and gain classified information for incoming national security officials. And in another sign of how the current administration is responding to the election results, the Washington Post reporting the White House Budget Office is being told to prepare a budget proposal for the 2022 fiscal year, which is typically released in February, 2 weeks after President Trump is set to end his term. You're listening to Washington Today. Politico reporting North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis has won a second term. He's receiving a concession call. He received a concession call from Democratic challenger Cal Cunningham. There are now 49 Republican senators with the outcome of Alaska's Senate race still yet to be determined, and the two Georgia state Republican runoff races set for early January. When it comes to those runoff races, The Hill reporting that former Georgia gubernatorial hopeful Stacey Abrams and her group Fair Fight Action have raised $6 million so far to help Democrats win those races. The Senate Judiciary Committee held the fourth hearing in its series of hearings on the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. You'll remember Crossfire Hurricane was the code name given to the FBI investigation that examined possible links between President Trump's campaign and Moscow and whether there was collusion to defeat Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton in the election 4 years ago. The committee heard testimony from Andrew McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI. McCabe, who was fired by then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions 2 days before his scheduled retirement in early 2018, was originally set to appear before the committee last month, but the session was postponed after several Republican senators tested positive for COVID-19. Here's an exchange between Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Mr. McCabe.
Let's make sure that the FBI treated both sides fairly. Senator Feinstein suggested it was right to open up the investigation against the Trump campaign. You say it was right. It was your duty. Let's look at the entire record of the 2016 election and see how even-handed the FBI was. On September the 7th, 2016, the CIA, now not the Australian ambassador of the United Kingdom in London, but our CIA sends an investigative lead over to the FBI. And they inform the FBI of U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's approval of a plan concerning U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump and Russian hackers hampering U.S. elections as a means of distracting the public from her use of a private mail service. How many agents were assigned to investigate that?
Senator, if you are referring to the memorandum, the raw intelligence memorandum recently declassified by the DNI.
Yeah.
I have read that memorandum, and I don't understand it to be a request for investigative activity. I'm not aware that any agents were assigned to investigate the
wait
information.
Wait a minute. Time out. You get a memo, an investigative lead is what the CIA calls it, alleging that Hillary Clinton had just signed off on a plan to tie Trump to Russia for political purposes. How many people looked at that? How many agents were assigned to see if it was true or not? Did you know about it?
I was not aware of that memorandum.
Wait a minute. Time out. You get a CIA memo, investigative lead memo, suggesting that the Democratic candidate for president, Hillary Clinton, is trying to divert attention from her email server problem by casting aspersions against the Trump campaign being connected to Russia, and you didn't know about it. How is that possible?
Senator, I'd like to explain to you how that's possible.
Who did it go to? I will. I just want to make sure if he understands who it went to. Who did the memo go to?
I read the memo recently. In my understanding, it went to Director Comey and was also to the attention of Peter Strzok. That memorandum that you're referring to, as I read it, is in response to an FBI request, oral request, for an update of the sort of information that the Crossfire Hurricane Task Force was reviewing about Russian activity in the campaign.
That was Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Andrew McCabe, former deputy director of the FBI, from earlier today. In a report last year, Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz found no political bias in the FBI's maneuvers, but said there were some errors. Among them, he said, the FBI did not meet its responsibility of, quote, heightened candor when it gave the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants for then-Trump campaign aide Carter Page.
What is the state of play in America today that the Senate Judiciary Committee might be interested in? Well, let's take a few items. We did have an election, a landmark moment in history. A sitting president, Donald Trump, who has routinely disrespected the rule of law, undermined democratic institutions, put his own interests ahead of the interests of the American people, ignored science and public health when it comes to this pandemic, and violated basic standards of honesty and decency in unprecedented numbers, a clear majority of Americans voted to say, that's it, we're finished with you, and replace him with President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, incidentally two senators who've served honorably on this committee. The election sent a clear message. It's time to stop relitigating issues of the last election. It's time, finally, to put behind us the divisiveness and vitriol of the Trump era and to bring our fractured country together to address COVID, number one, and put our economy back on its feet. But here we are today, 7 days after that election, and our committee is holding another partisan hearing to advance President Trump's theories. This is the fourth hearing this year on the last administration, the previous administration's Justice Department, in response to President Trump's repeated calls to investigate the investigators and to try to rewrite the story of Russia's involvement in the 2016 campaign. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee that we sit on here hasn't held a single oversight hearing on the Trump administration's Justice Department in this Congress. Any issues we might want to raise? I can think of a few. Perhaps we might even investigate the Department of Homeland Security and their zero tolerance policy. I regret what happened to Carter Page, and I've said so before, but I also regret what happened to 2,200 infants, toddlers, and children who were physically removed from their parents by the zero tolerance policy of the Trump administration and the fact that 545 of those children still are in an abandoned status today. 545. So my question, as has been asked to the witness before us today, is who should be held responsible? Why wouldn't the Senate Judiciary Committee even care to have a hearing? Why wouldn't the Immigration Subcommittee, which I am a ranking member on with the senator from Texas, even have one hearing on that issue? None. But this is the fourth hearing we're having, going back over this well-plowed ground. There are some timely issues related to the Department of Justice we might even have considered today. Let me give you one. Yesterday, Attorney General Bill Barr issued a memo authorizing federal prosecutors to, quote, pursue substantial allegations of voting and vote tabulation regularities prior to the certification of elections. The Attorney General's memo represents another instance of his sacrificing the reputation of the Department of Justice to serve the political interests of President Donald Trump. Attorney General Barr is clearly attempting to fabricate a veneer of legitimacy for the baseless claims of voter fraud made by President Trump and his supporters. And he's doing so by overriding longstanding Department of Justice policies that were put in place to prevent this very type of political interference in an election season. Let me tell you what the previous guidelines that previous attorney generals honored said. Quote, public knowledge of a criminal investigation could impact the adjudication of election litigation and contest in state courts. Accordingly, it is the general policy of the Justice Department not to conduct overt investigations. End of quote. Attorney General Barr jettisoned that standard yesterday.
And that was Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois. To date, there have been three hearings before the committee on the matter. During the most recent in September, former FBI Director Jim Comey defended the Bureau's actions under his leadership. Former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates testified before the committee in August, and former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appeared in June. You can find all of those hearings at our website at cspan.org. Thank you for joining us today here on Washington Today. If you've missed any of this program, remember you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.